Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Wonderful to be with you, practicing with you. My name is Ryushin Hart, pronouns he, they. And for those who have attended talks with me before, know that I start with an invocation. I feel like in these times we are really in it, and we are going to be continuing to be in this climate crisis for a good while. So if there are energy, spirits, forces that want to help us, I feel like let's call them in. So I'll say some words, and if there are some other energies that you find helpful to call in, please, by all means. So Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, enlightened masters, Dharma protectors, Naga and Yo, Vajrapani, Dharma protecting Devas, spirits of the elemental forces, fire, water, earth, air, wind, sun, moon, wind, rain, snow, stars, spirits of the mountains, of the trees and animals, plants, medicines, spirits of love, light, and respect, of metta, karuna, upekkha, and mudita, spirits of the crossroads. Please be with us and our good, true, and well ancestors. Please be with us, guide us, and protect us as we are here today. Please help to open our eyes and open our ears that we may see and hear that which we most need to hear to continue on this journey of integration, integrity, of embodiment, and entering into right relationship with the world around us. And I've also started to add a land acknowledgement. You may have heard these in different contexts. And really, partly about recognizing that we all sit on land in the United States, at least that is unceded, that was held by others who cared for it before we came to call it home. So taking a moment to recognize that each of us lives on unceded ancestral land, I'm joining you from the unceded land of the Kalapuya and Chippewa tribes. These indigenous people tried to live in right relationship with the natural world and recognizing trees and plants, animals, the mountains as their community members. And the majority of those tribal members died from diseases introduced by Europeans. The members who survived were forcefully removed from their homelands by European settlers, and the contemporary descendants of the Kalapuya are members of the Confederated Tribe of Grand Ronde, Oregon. The intention is to bear witness to our country's history of settler colonialism and to remind us of our responsibility as inhabitants of this land to cultivate those relationships with all the many beings of the natural world. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about the precepts.
Excuse me, Ryushin. Sorry to break in, but we normally do announcements before we get into the Dharma talk.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
What we usually do is we go around and acknowledge everybody who's here. And if I could do that, I'll start with that, and then I have an announcement after that. So I'd like to recognize, of course, Ryushin, our guest speaker tonight, Tracy, Linda B, that is, Alice Holland, coming in from somewhere in the Southwest, I presume. I'm not sure if she's home yet or not, but she's a traveling lady.
Ohio.
Ohio. Ohio goes a lot. Oh, I'm sorry. too many Japanese.
No, like
too
like
many
the
Japanese
Michigan,
classes.
Ohio.
John, Ruth Ann, Sabrina, Joseph, Pat, Paulette, Betty, Jinryu, Emilia, Jim, Nikki, Marv, Mark, Shoketsu, Linda R, Brian, and Ellen T. Good morning to all. Well, I am Bob Kemter on the board of directors for the Brightway Zen Center, and I'd like to take a moment to talk about our Brightway Zen fundraiser called Brightway Forward. Perhaps by now you've received a letter about our fundraising project. One of us on the board is going to contact you, if you received one, over the next few weeks. This is not a single event. We're going to be continuing this through almost the end of October. October 20th is our goal to end this. And we're looking forward to garnering a 10% increase in our donations in this campaign. We haven't done much of this campaigning in the last couple of years because of the current crazy conditions. And we're hoping to get 10%, but that means if everybody gave 10%, we could easily meet our goal. We recognize that not everyone can do that right now. It's been a tough year for all of us, and I appreciate that. Most of all, we appreciate your attendance and participation at our services and classes, and of course, we appreciate what you have given us so far. Well, we want to emphasize that we are only asking people to give what they are comfortable in giving, given their each individual circumstance. What we want to also talk about is our contact with you is a chance for those of us who are on the board to contact and visit with our fellow Sangha members. I know that I can talk to a handful, but there's limited time and not that much bandwidth for people to talk to each other in these Zoom meetings as much as we'd like to. But with that, I will turn it back to Ryoshin, and thank you very much for your attendance to what I said. Thank you much.
So part of the reason that I've been thinking about the precepts a little bit more preparing for this talk is just seeing some of the ways how common decency is eroding. Perhaps associated with being isolated, more polarization of views, and just with climate crisis, a rise in fear, a rise in shame, distrust. And I, for myself, when I see that there is a tendency that arises to feel hopeless about humanity and our future, and I find a helpful antidote in trying to live an ethical life. So it's also the 20th year since I took the precepts and want to just was reflecting on a little bit about that journey and insights along the way. So I see many wagesas and roxus or neckties and bibs. So some people have definitely practiced with the precepts, but for those who might be newer, in Zen and Buddhism, there are 16 vows, commonly called the precepts, that form an ethical framework for reflecting on our thoughts and our speech and our actions, interactions. When I first learned about the precepts, I was honestly excited. I really wanted to be a good Zen student. And in some ways, Zen makes that easy because there is a way that you enter the Zendo. There is a way that you sit down. There is a way that you walk. There is a way that you hold your hands for Gassho. And so in my mind, there was an idea that if I just knew the rules of the precepts, I could follow them perfectly and be a good Zen student. And it took a little bit to realize that was just a iteration of perfectionism, perfectionism is not healthy striving. Perfectionism tells this alluring story that there's one right way to do something, and if we do it right, then we can avoid blame and shame and criticism that it's not true. And tied to it is the recognition that that motivation has nothing to do about benefiting the world. It's all about getting some avoidance of criticism. So, and it shows up in other ways. I something to keep an eye on in spiritual practice is the tendency to want to put something up on a pedestal, whether it's Buddhism or Zen Buddhism or Buddhist teachers or your Sangha, and it's seductive. So the precepts, there are 16 of them, and they are broken down into three different chunks, three different baskets. The first one are the refuges, so taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the Dharma or the truth, the teachings that lead towards awakening, and the Sangha or the community of people sincerely trying to wake up and to live in harmony with their life. Those unfold into the next category of ceasing to cause harm, striving to do good, and striving to do to be of service to benefit others. And since those two categories can be a little bit harder to pin down, the last basket of 10 provide a little bit more concrete around not killing, not lying, not stealing, misusing sex or intoxicants, not gossiping, praising ourselves by criticizing others, giving vent to anger, not being stingy with resources, and not speaking of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Each vow is can be seen like a great piece of art where we could spend hours in presence with it, seeing it from different aspects, and we could spend this whole time talking about just one precept, like the vow not to kill but to cherish all life. What is killing? And are we only talking about don't shoot somebody walking down the street? What does it look like to cherish life? What is going on there? Is it possible that we are killing or cherishing life right here as we're sitting? In my experience, sitting with the precepts tends to leave me with more questions than answers, which I find to be a helpful place to be, to rest in the not knowing rather than the security, the seduction of, oh, now I get it. Now I can put it in a little box and say that I understand what it is and I don't have to think about it again. Early on, my root teachers would say that we're never done learning with the precepts. And now after 5, 10, 20 years of reflection, it's also been my experience. So I find that there are three fundamental ways that we can relate to the precepts. There is the, for lack of a better word, vigilance dimension of, I sincerely commit to this precept to take refuge in the Buddha. I sincerely commit to not steal. I will invest myself wholeheartedly in that. I will strive to live that precept to its fullest. And then there's the dimension of humility, that the deeper I look into any of these precepts, the deeper I look at my own mind and heart and imperfections, the more I recognize that I am falling short constantly. And sitting with that humility of mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake, year after year. And that's the second dimension. The third dimension is that absolute perspective, the perspective that, say, God would have, a timeless creature would have, where words dissolve, where the separation between us, even through these screens, disappears, the distinction between me and the tree outside loses all of its context and relevance. And in that light, what does killing even mean? So none of these is the right perspective. They are three different ways of conceptualizing. And it seems to be the case that often people orient primarily towards one of these three a little bit more than the other two, perhaps, and that there's something to be gained about recognizing, oh, this is my comfort zone. My comfort zone is the commitment level, or the I'm a failure level, or the it's all good. I do whatever I want, no problem. And instead, learning how to dance between the three, to juggle them, and recognizing where the gap is, and bringing it in. While still being able to, at the end of the day, engage in our lives and make decisions. There's often a period, or from my own experience, a period of time where there's a freezing up of, it seems like there's no way to win. So maybe if I just do nothing, then I'll be able to live them perfectly. And that's just another trap. I would suggest that's just another trap. So after people reflect on these precepts, they go through a formal ceremony of receiving them. And there's something different that happens. Most people reflect that there's a change, an internal change that happens, versus just reading them on a page or reading them out loud to yourself in your room. But going through a public ceremony with someone who has the permission to entrust you with those precepts, sewing a garment that you will wear as a physical reminder of those vows and intentions. And in addition to that change that we experience, there's a change in our relationship to others, right? We all appreciate, I think, when somebody takes responsibility for their anger. And it's different if someone's made a public declaration that they will deeply explore their anger, and then we see them making harmful comments. It lands in a different way, where we say, but you said you were going to not do that. You said you were going to try to practice with that, versus just our general expectation, which kind of sweeping through these different areas, it leads to this piece about how do we repair, because there's the way that decency is eroding in our culture, and there's also that we're losing some of the knowledge about how to respectfully discuss when harm happens, and how people make amends, and how to welcome them back into the community after they've repaired the damage, worked on themselves, gained some insight. On a committee for the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, a professional organization for Soto Zen priests, developing, refining a grievance policy in addition to the ethics policy that says, here are the things that we as priests, Soto Zen Buddhist priests, will not do. The grievance policy says, when harm has occurred, how does the Sangha evaluate it, reflect on it, offer their best sense, and how does that person come back into integrity? So there's an acknowledgement that when we take the precepts, we're going to fail. And we are making, those of us who undertake the precepts, are making a commitment to learn from our mistakes. So that there's an implicit request there to our Sangha to support us, and often the greatest help comes from pointing out our blind spots, right? We can only see, if you think just our visual field, we can only see about this much. There's all that back there that's out of our sight. Only somebody else can tell me if I missed a spot shaving on my head. So fortunately, there are instructions in Buddhism about how we come back into relationship, how we reprove someone, how to give that feedback in a way that can best support someone hearing it, and instructions about how to receive when we are told that we have our actions or our speech has caused someone harm, caused someone difficulty or distress. And then one other piece is in terms of staying oriented towards the precepts, I found helpful is renewing them. At the monastery where I trained, we held a ceremony once a month to silently reflect on the ways that we fell short in the last month, and then to verbally renew these vows, to take them back on, say, okay, any mistakes I've made, let me try to address them, let me try to forgive myself for them, so that I can move forward and say, and now I renew. Even though I made a mistake, even though I know that I'm going to make more mistakes, I sincerely renew my intentions to live these to the best of my ability. I was looking at the calendar for Brightway. I didn't see it as a ceremony. I don't know if it is a ceremony that's done here, but it's a powerful way to connect with Sangha, particularly those who have also taken these vows about these common intentions to live ethically, especially in a culture where we go out into the world. We don't live in monastic community. We go out into the world and other people have not made those commitments. How powerful to renew among this subgroup the intentions. So one other thought, and then very interested to shift and hear be in dialogue, discussion about how the precepts live in you. There, one of my root teachers lived for many years in a Zen temple as part of their training, and they lived there with their family. So their kids were raised in a Zen center. And when they left, their daughter was about a teenager. And so the story goes, she was fairly critical of the community there, saying, it's pretty hypocritical that y'all are making these vows to not gossip and to be generous. And I see everybody living day in and day out. And there are lots of ways that people are not living up to these. And then they went out, they went to college, they started to have a family. And so the story goes, they came back around to their parents after, say, a decade or so of life, and said, there's a different perspective now that I have. I still feel like there were a lot of areas where what was said and what was done didn't quite sync up. What I see now is at least people there were trying. How many people out in the world are simply not trying? And how powerful is it to even hold the intention and renew the intention, even as we make mistakes, even as we fall short again and again and again, to refresh and say, let me start fresh today with my vows. Let me try to learn from my stumbles and mistakes. Let me try to apologize when I make a mistake and recognize that's part of the package deal, and see how to maintain harmony here. So those are a few thoughts, and now really interested to hear other thoughts or comments, reflections from your experience of living the precepts, exploring them, there's wisdom among us.
I will start. I really appreciate your bringing the precepts up, because at Bright Ways End, we study them pretty intensely from around February until May. And then typically in May, we have our Jukai ceremony. It's moved around the calendar several times in the past 2 years because of the pandemic, but that has been our practice in the past. And so I really find it refreshing to hear them spoken about at some time other than that window of precept intensity that we have once a year. Because I, in my own heart, believe that they're just such a part of our whole practice. And I don't entirely know where I'm going with this, but they are so encompassing. And I have found them difficult to really try and keep as a whole. So I have to zero in on one. And one of the ways that we, that supports that is that people who have taken the precepts in the past at Bright Ways Zen pick up one and offer it to the group. And I have found that incredibly beneficial toward helping me focus on something. But one thing I wanted to share, how you introduced this made me think of this conversation I had, a month or so ago, 2 months maybe, with friends who are not Buddhists. And this one woman said, well, I know you're a Buddhist and you try to practice all this stuff and, you know, you're just on the path to righteousness and all that stuff. And I said, it's not about righteousness. It's not that at all, that you are totally missing the point. It's about happiness. If I do these things, I will be happier. And I just think that is what is so rewarding, at least about my own practice. And I agree. I hope others can talk about how to take this out into the world more, because, you know, just the level of road rage and airplane rage and political rage, and it's like we have stopped learning how to communicate with each other completely.
Yeah, very much agree with the focusing on one. Often in the conversations where discussions I've had where we take up a precept and we look at, usually by the end of the hour, we're finding threads of how that one precept tethered to the others, and how beautiful it is that it's part of this cloth that's woven together. Thank you. Yeah, Ellen.
Hi, morning or good afternoon. I'm on the East Coast, so I'm operating on those hours. But I do feel like it's true that your children kind of hold you to a standard that is interesting. And I have two teenagers, 17 and 18, who will be the first to point out when you fall away from your vows. They're very aware of the process that I've gone through. I took precepts in June, and that I had been studying for several years. And so they were involved not really super interested necessarily for their own sakes, but watching it closely, and they'll step up and say, but I thought Buddhism meant this or that, and that's not what you're doing. So I find that that's actually useful, and that sometimes I can even figure out a way to turn it around and teach them something or other accessible. But yeah, I do feel like it's, if I don't, you know, I find, I would find hard, find it hard to explain away really breaking a precept, breaking a vow, because they would be my little chorus of conscience in my household.
Wonderful for you to be able to take that framework. And there's definitely, I can relate to that from my own experience, not with children, but just in general, with taking the precepts and trying to, part of that feels like, taking the precepts feels like saying, I will take my life as a teaching, and I will take the beings that enter my life as my teachers. And that includes the young ones and the old ones and the plant-based ones and the mountain-based ones and the human-based ones. Yeah. Beautiful.
Thank you for being here today with us.
Yeah. Honored. Honored.
Thank you for your story about the young person who moving away from Zen community 10 years later could see that people were trying. For myself, I favor, instead of the word trying, not striving. Strive comes from an old French word that means to quarrel and fight. I favor the ease of effort, because we're very hard on ourselves sometimes, and to a point that can be self-reflection is necessary. But if awakening to our behavior was so easy, it wouldn't be something we had to do for ourselves, you know, to come off of being sleepwalkers. So awakening just does not, it doesn't come in with the sunshine. So I like the idea of easing into reflecting and not sort of beating ourselves up. I love the phrase, the goalless goal. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Yeah, the as you're talking, I'm reminded of the, so in Zen Buddhism we have the 16 precepts, and those are a distillation of and there's obviously a lot of reasons why they were distilled, but in the Theravadan tradition, the East Asian tradition, there are 227 for bhikkhus. And when there's, in the teachings of the Buddha, there are the stories that go along with how they came to have 227 rules of getting together, of all the shenanigans that come along with living in harmony with people. And they stole my bowl, and they, this person tickled a monk, and they were surprised the monk, and they had a heart attack. And now we need to say, no tickling monks. And just some very delightful and amusing anecdotes about how they came to, but all with the underlying theme of, how do we live together? How do people from so many different backgrounds, in the Buddha's time, it was people coming from all the different castes, from the Brahmins, the wealth class, down to the untouchables, all coming together with different education experiences and creating this tapestry, creating this this beautiful integrated sangha, and all the messiness that comes along with human beings living in relationship day in and day out. And how do you create? Sangha is sometimes translated as harmony, How do you create harmony from such a disparate collection? So some amusing reading if you're so inspired about history of the precepts. Other thoughts, comments, questions, wisdom from your exploration of the precepts? We create our own tapestry here by the 23 people, along with whoever ends up watching the recordings.
I guess I can talk. So I have not formally taken the precepts yet, and it was for the exact reason you were discussing, which is while I've been practicing and trying to integrate these for many years now, formally taking that step and making that commitment in front of others that this is a lifelong thing I'm going to commit to and try, I take very seriously. And I for myself want to make sure I understand this and really understand this commitment that I'm formally going to make in front of others so I can hold true to it for others and myself. And I found that, while I've been exploring these, in times where I have those seconds where I decide, I'm not going to do this precept right now, I'm mad. This is what, I'm going to get upset. I'm going to yell, or I'm going to write that nasty email. I find that not only does it create pain for others, it also creates this pain in myself and how interrelated that is. And so I think for me and where I'm at right now, I'm really looking forward to, I think, studying the precepts more and take those next steps, because it really is from multiple painful learning experiences do I find that it really does make an impact on myself and developing compassion for others.
Appreciate you sharing your experience, and definitely it resonates with my own. I'm not going to remember. There is a Buddhist teaching associated with this, but I'm blanking on the specific reference point. There's a overlap with I believe it's called Pascal's Wager, where he was asked about, is there, why be good if you don't know that there's an afterlife where you're going to get some reward? And his comment was, well, if you live well, you get the benefit now. You are not trying to track all the lies that you've told, which takes a lot of mental energy. You're not having to keep track of the places and the people who you've harmed by your angry speech and actions, broken relationships. You're not having to, I work in my other role is in a restorative justice program, a drug treatment court model with people who have been convicted of felonies and are in a year-long program coming back into the community and making right the mistakes that they have encountered, rebuilding friendships and family connections after substance abuse and crime and stealing and just seeing how that takes so much effort. And it just creates this wave that's following after you, or this weight that you're dragging around. So the wager is, we get the benefit right now by not having to have, our life is just simpler and easier when we're able to live in harmony with the precepts. And even when we are at our best, when you are in love, you're usually not inspired to harm people. when you are deeply in love and it's a beautiful summer day, you are unlikely to be inspired to steal from someone. You're unlikely to give vent to anger. And so they cause less drag for us right here and right now? And then should there be something that happens in the future and there's some judgment, then bonus points. But you get the reward right now. So very much resonating with what you're sharing, Tracy. Thank you. Alice, please.
Tracy, I'm so glad that you shared what you shared, because I too go through some issues where like, I'm just too angry about this right now and I'm not gonna, let go from the jaws of teeth. I totally get that. And I haven't done the precepts either. I plan to like later on when COVID's ended and we can just do it in person. But I had to share something that I read recently about the precepts that was really, really like touched me, was from that book by Kjølgen Carlson that we're supposed to be reading. I think You Are Still Here. He talks about the precepts being kind of a conduit in which you can understand karmic consequence, which I liked how he phrased that, because it's not so much like the precepts being the commandments where you have to do this, you have to do that, and you will be a good person if you do that, or you'll be a good Buddhist if you do that, but rather like a respect or an understanding, you know, kind of like coming away from the trees and looking at the forest and going, oh, now I see that some of my actions and mistakes cause consequences in others and painful, that kind of like, and you know, that it circles around back to you in some form or another, and in ways that you never even predicted. Which I think it resonates to me, because then you have a respect for every single action and thing you say. And by no means do I say anything right most of the time. that's all I have to share.
Thank you. Yeah. It's so humbling to commit to something knowing it's, I mean, people commit to marriage, right? And what is love, honor, and cherish on the days where you're just grumpy and under resourced, and you know, maybe if you have kids, you haven't gotten a lot of sleep. What does love, honoring, and cherishing look like on those days? Like knowing that there's just, we're gonna fail. There's no two ways about it. We are going to fail, and still being willing. I have such great respect for people who are willing to take those commitments and to try. Even if you're, for myself, I know some other people as well, try to live as if you took the precepts before you take the precepts. You know, even that, wonderful, you know, makes a difference. Yeah, Brian.
So I've had some occasion to think about forgiveness over the last week or two, and was connecting that to the precept not to dwell on past mistakes. And I was really thinking about that, the mechanism of forgiveness and how that did compare to dwelling or not dwelling. And I was listening to a sort of poet philosopher who had done a lot of Zen, David White. And he talked about this wound or this injury as something that was going to be enduring, that it and perhaps it was healthy for it too. It's like scar tissue, or it's how we learn to avoid either doing something or being vulnerable to something or something like that. But that there was another side to it, or another dimension, which. Where we cultivated a larger understanding of the situation, of the people who were in it, what may have led to the particular situation that merited forgiveness or called for it. And it did seem to resonate with the notion of not dwelling, you know, not getting sort of stuck in this, you know, the sense of being hurt or wounded, or having, you know, inflicted hurt or wound, on someone. And but recognizing that it would be there, it wasn't going to not have happened. It happened. But rather than staying fixated on it, kind of moving into this other place where you were, putting it into context and really empathizing with whomever had been involved with the situation, and then moving from that understanding to care, concern, love, whatever the so. So to your, I guess, earlier point that these are very rich, the precepts are very rich and, merit lots of reflection and have a good deal of resonance in different parts of life.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah. And living in a culture where we're so steeped in shame, can we practice that forgiveness for ourselves and that kindness and care for ourselves when we have made mistakes. We're usually hardest on ourselves. Yeah. I saw in the chat that Mark is not able to raise a hand, but has a hand raised.
You mentioned the erosion of decency. And I was just thinking about that yesterday and struggling with what to make of it, because the precepts are an ethos of behavior founded upon seeing the way that it is, right? And there are any number of other ethoses in the world. My best friend, his ethos is everybody should have as much fun as possible, right? Which sounds silly, except I've seen him take his children aside and say, stop doing that because you're ruining it for the other kids. Mm. But it seems to me that more and more I see people who have no ethos at all. Their founding ethos is I get what I want and anything that's in the way gets broken. And that's where my decency starts to erode, my sheer frustration with that. And I was wondering if you had any practical counsel on how to practice with that.
I feel like each person, I can't speak to what will work for each person. I can only speak to what works for me. And what I find helpful is to take in beauty and goodness and remind myself that that exists. So yesterday that looked like there's a fall festival here in Corvallis, going down and seeing artisans and beautiful, incredible pieces of art that have been made with fabric and stone and copper and just taking in beauty. I find it helpful. I've taken the next week off of work and I'm doing a silent retreat. So disconnecting from the world periodically is one way that I maintain sanity and stability, care for my own heart and mind. And then it may seem flippant, but maybe that's just my own sense. I find the longer that I'm a Buddhist, the more that I find the Dharma in everything. And so one place that I've been finding it recently is in the show Ted Lasso, which is just this beautiful story about one person who believes in kindness, believes in the power of kindness to change culture, and how one person practicing kindness and believing in the goodness of people can change all around them. And it's a story, but there are examples. The reason that Dr. King and Gandhi continue to, and Mother Teresa continue to have such weight is because they were manifestations of that. I refuse to see other than the goodness, to believe other than the goodness, even as I am in contact with the pain and the suffering and the examples of the other. But within that, I will stay in contact with reality and grounded to the truth that we are all fundamentally good. We're all fundamentally, we get narrow at times, but we are all fundamentally good. And so that's one recent example that for me is just a little heartwarming, inspiring reminder of goodness.
Thank you.
Yeah. Paulette.
Thank you for that. I like that show too. Yeah, I struggle with the precept of speech and anger. And I've noticed though, when I'm dealing with it, that it actually hurts my throat when I say things that are harmful. It's actually physically affects me. So I think my struggle or my practice is re-evaluating my relationship with anger. Because I used to think of it as writing an angry email or expressing my opinion about something. And I'm not sure if that's at this point the best way to get a message across, because I'm finding more and more that people don't listen when you speak out of frustration and anger. And so what's the best way to communicate that frustration that I'm having, or concern or discontent with the world or people's lack of morals and ethics and ethos? So, you know, I'm trying to redefine my relationship with anger, and it's a constant practice, but something that I feel like it's necessary at this point. And I'm a school teacher, so I'm also have a sore throat from talking all week. Hasn't been all bad speech, but how do I speak skillfully and not with a core of anger or discontent? It's constantly a practice.
Thank you for sitting with the question, right? Because it'll probably, if you sit with it, you'll say, oh, well, maybe I try this thing, right? And so you try that and see, is that more effective or less effective? And you continue to sit with the question, oh, there's these people I continue to not be able to relate to or communicate with about my anger. They don't hear me. How do I communicate with them? Sitting with it. Maybe another idea, concept, action comes forward. You think about there are some examples of protests that have expressed their frustration in very creative ways that managed to get the attention that they were seeking without buying into the whole anger thing. Because yeah, like you're saying, anger lets us know that there's a boundary that's been crossed, right? But it's usually not the most helpful way. It's often not the most helpful way to reassert. It has its place. There's another piece in there. The other piece just to add in that in terms of this sitting with the precepts and noticing how different dimensions open up the longer that the way that I show up to them, that each of us shows up to them in different ways, is having greater cultural competency, humility, and recognizing that when we're talking about anger, that we also have to consider all the stories that get told about who's allowed to be angry, right? If we're male-bodied, if we're white and male-bodied, we may have been taught that's the only emotion that you're allowed to communicate. If you're Black and male-bodied, you've been maybe taught that if you're angry, it could be a death sentence. If you're female-bodied, you might have been taught, no, don't, you'll get called names, right? And so that's just it's another layer that to take into account in terms of that if people have been taught that they're not allowed to express anger, then my humble opinion, my opinion would be that there may be a need there to create space for shouting or punching or doing those things that culture has said, you're not allowed to do that. Say, culture doesn't get to say what I do, which is different than what you're talking about of my voice is giving me the feedback that anger is not the way to engage with anger. So just bringing in that it's complex. There isn't a right answer. There's not a right answer for one person. There's not a right answer for the course of our life. And it's really just staying in the unknown, staying in the questions. So really appreciate you sharing your exploration, because I imagine that it has wisdom there for others here. Thank you. So we're about at time. Bob, is there anything before I dedicate the merit in terms of our Right Ways traditions?
We still have a couple of minutes, and I don't believe so. Mark, who's the actual host.
No, I believe that's it.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, let's end with a dedication of merit. Well, I guess first, just great appreciation for you all being here, for you all supporting, even in these strange times where we connect to these strange platforms, that there is something, and that I imagine that we all can feel it, of the coming together, even through technology. There's something different of sitting together, and how precious that is to have a place, to have a time where we know, okay, I will come and I will sit on a Sunday for this period of time. I'll hear a talk, I'll reflect on it, and allow it to ripple out into my consciousness and my interactions. So precious, precious, precious. And to dedicate the merit that may any goodness that comes from these words, these practices, these prayers that we have offered today, may they be a drop of water in the ocean of good deeds performed by all Buddhism, Bodhisattvas, enlightened masters, that we and all beings may be able to realize truth, that we may be able to open our hearts, stay connected to our hearts through the pain and the loss and the transformation that is happening in these times, that we may tune into our place in the great awakening of this time, that we may play our small part or great part in whatever way we are called to. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all.
Thank you, Roshan.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.